Well, I've said this before, but it strikes me just more all the time. You never know where your life is going to lead you. I want to thank Katya for inviting me up here, and because it's a great series, but also because this was a really important place in my life at a really crucial time in my life. I lived here from between 1967 to 1970. You know, that was the, like, Expo and War Measures Act. And I was a student at, part-time student at Concordia. We called it Sir George Williams then, and I was in the military station at St. Hubert. So I was right in the thick of what was going on in those 3 years. I came downtown today early just to walk around. I used to live in Weardale Park, just over there. And I walked by this library I don't know how many times. But I was 23 years old and single and male. I don't think I came through that front door too often back in those days. And I went over to Lincoln Street, where I used to live, and I went over to the Montfort Apartments. That used to be a new building. Boy, it's just looking pretty shabby now. I lived in there with my closest friend, who's still my closest friend. And I'm not going to tell you, I'm not going to get into this because I don't have enough time to do this tonight. But I remember one thing about him. He was working, he decided he was going to make a career in the bank because his father had been a banker, a manager of one of the banks on St. Catherine. He grew up in town of Mount Royal. And on the way from a branch to the main bank, Tom lost $1 million check. And I remember the trauma of that experience, and what he realized at that point was he probably wasn't going to have a career in banking. So he left, and he went back to Dalhousie, and he did, I guess, what a lot of people do when they're not very good at handling other people's money. He went to law school. So, and now he's a very successful lawyer with, you know, they start out with two or three in a firm, and there's 40 of them down there. So anyhow, but you know, the most important structure for me here was the forum. I mean, that was a magic place for me. I spent a lot of time in that building, and I don't think people realize the historical importance of that place. I was there the night Serge Savard, right in front of me, slid into the goalpost and broke his leg. But there were so many other really important things that happened there. You know, I mean, we all know about the Richard riots and all that kind of stuff, but I have an image of Ted Lindsay in there in 1953, I think it was, when Detroit came in here and beat Montreal in the seventh game of the Stanley Cup. And Ted Lindsay, one of the toughest men that ever played the game, I have this image of him with a black eye. He'd been warned not to play. A letter was sent to him: "If you come to this game, we will kill you." That was Montreal fans. And after the game, Ted Lindsay, being Ted Lindsay, stood up at center ice and put his hockey stick like a machine gun and just circled around there and waved that stick at everybody in the building. That happened just like 60 yards over there, you know, and there were so many wonderful things went on there. When I was doing my research for this book, I interviewed a lot of people in this area too. Talked to Red Fisher, and I talked to Dick Irvin, and I guess the one, of all the players I talked to, the one person I really lost it with and became a fan again was Butch Bouchard, the captain of the Montreal Canadiens back in the early 50s. He was just the most impressive man, I think, that I had ever spoken. He was well over 80 at that particular point. I know he's not well now, and I was so happy when I saw they retired his number at the forum. But the person who told me the most was Red Story, who lived over in NDG. I spent an entire day with Red Story, and it was just a very profitable day for me because Red was very much caught up with Terry Sawchuk as well, fascinated with him, 40 years after still trying to figure out the guy. And Red had just had a stroke, and he was recovering. And when I went to speak to him in his house, he was, you know, he was such a big man, such a wonderful athlete himself, and went on to become an NHL referee who walked away from the league when Clarence Campbell wouldn't support him in something that happened in Chicago one night. But it was a wonderful experience. I must have talked to him for 8 or 9 hours. I knew he wasn't well, and after about an hour, I said, "Red, I guess you know I should leave. You know, I should go." "No, no, I'll just tell you one more story." This went on the whole day long, and I could hear his wife. She was out there. It was his second wife, scraping the wallpaper off the walls, and I have the smell of wallpaper remover in my nose still when I think of that day. But it was just an absolutely wonderful experience. So I thought to sort of tailor this reading a little bit to you know, toward the area where we are, that I might just try to not so much focus on Terry tonight as people like Red Story and maybe Doug Harvey and Toe Blake, John Beliveau, people like that. This the way this book comes out, it's just a whole bunch of different voices, you know, and it has a kind of chaos, because that's the way it was in my head. I did this research, as I say, for 10 years. I interviewed so many people that's the way it was in my head. And the first person pronoun I is a lot of different people. Sometimes it's me, the writer. Sometimes it's the interviewer. Sometimes it's Terry talking. Sometimes it's people talking about Terry. So to try and impose some order on this, I had various ways of doing it, and one of them was, I used two poems that deal with Red Story right at the beginning of the book. And they focus on the thing that haunted Red about Terry was a question that he, Terry, had come to ask Red just before a game started. I'm not going to tell you what that question is, because you can find out in the book, buy the book. It's in those opening poems, and I use that just as a kind of hook through the book. And then there's two prose sections called Big Dogs, where I have Terry, where I have Red talking about Terry. So he provides me with a kind of organizational principle in the book. This is the first poem, called Neither Rhyme Nor Reason. In old films, the ice looks more like winter. The boards were boards and clear. I see the lone official out for a skate, flipping a puck in the air. He seems in no rush for the teams to appear, his long stride preoccupied and familiar. He swings by again, and I see it's him, Red Story, younger here than that long afternoon in his home with his souvenirs and second wife. I think of him there in his chair, his legs wrapped in a blanket. He lifts his hands and looks at them absently, turning them slowly back to front. The massive hands that sent off Harvey and Howe placated the rocket and Lindsay and Eddie Shore. He says she taught him how to use a spoon again and hold a pen and clear the clutter of his memory. Now she's taking his old brick house apart, peeling the years from his walls, pulling down shadowy paper, looking for the house beneath. What were you thinking of, Red, gliding by so long ago? How ragged the ice in the forum seemed after Detroit? How to keep the crowd from lynching Bloody Lindsay? Or that subtler trouble with Sawchuk, who'd lead the Red Wings onto the ice? He told his first wife about that moment, the two teams slowly circling, tension building, and Terry veering over to ask that crazy question. Where to begin with the guy? Even after 50 years, it nags him like a wrinkle on his ankle. When he came to me wanting to know, Jesus, I thought he was joking. The winter day gives in. He tugs the blanket close around his knees. But even as I rise in the darkening room to go, the voice begins again. The talk on trains. Lindsay waiting in the tunnel and waving a stick in his face. A voice in Boston that could rub the skin right off you. Hey, Story, ya bum. We got a town down here named after you. Finally, his wife appears to mention the hour, reaching in to switch on the light. You hear an edge in her voice, too, a toughness you'd want in any scrap with time. Out in the hallway, the acid fumes of wallpaper strip her warning to watch the icy steps. Red talked a lot about Terry and about the goaltenders from that period and just the kind of pressure that they had to deal with. You know, this was the pre-mask era, and the teams were carrying one goaltender at the time. You know, when you got cut, they took you off the ice, they stitched you up, they didn't bother using anesthetic because there wasn't time for it to take, and then they sent you back out. It was a really difficult time to play goal. And around that period, this is when Bobby Hull is, you know, the slap shot, Geoffrion's got the slap shot going, Hull's moving in with the hook stick, and these guys just didn't have the protection. Terry played 21 years in a position that no one else lasted longer than 11, just because of the pressures of playing that in that position that he chose. This is a poem that deals with that to some extent. Terry was not a good husband. He had seven children. He was not a good father. you just, you know, to deal with the pressures, these guys resorted to things like women and alcohol. Terry was a terrible alcoholic by the time his life ended, which was at the age of 40. He was killed as a result of injuries sustained in a fight with Ronnie Stewart, a teammate. But it was, you know, the kinds of things that they used as refuges to sort of deal with the pressure to only created more problems for them. This poem called Game Days, it mentions Lefty. Lefty Wilson was a trainer in Detroit who made the first mask for Terry. And it mentions Ralph Backstrom as well, who was, of course, one of the great players in Montreal back in the golden age. My brother went up with the Blackhawks in 71 and ended up playing with Ralph in Chicago, with the Chicago Cougars. So I spent a lot of time talking to Ralph Backstrom about Terry in general and the 67 series in particular, which is a kind of focal point in this book. This is a poem called Game Days. Woke to an unwelcome darkness at the window. Terry's talking. The clock unset. No sing-song call through the locked door. The silence out there too familiar. What woke me? Those kittens she got to get rid of the mice off the golf course. Nervy buggers. Cats. They gallop over the bed. Who let them in? The door locked, as I said. Slept on my bad side again. The elbow slowly disintegrates. More bone for the jar when the season's done. Slowly I come to the surface, and there they are, locked in a fierce embrace. They rip at each other and bump together over the floor. One disengages, distracted by a toppled shoe. The other creeps closer, tail twitching, ready to leap that moving, not moving cat's trick with motion. I think of Backstrom. Lucky, I call him. He can't figure why. He glances up and his stick comes off the ice. Hey, Lucky, how do you feel tonight? God, there's moments you love this game. There's the phone. Lefty having a heart attack. Quickly I dress and come into the kitchen's gaping silence. There's where my plate hit the wall. Goaltender's theater. A woman and children taken to the road like refugees. I close my eyes and hear an unrepentant murmur from the living room. Some dreary talk show guest. I'm not your girl next door, if you want to know. The sound, left low, is always game days. I see the bedroom game is done. They sit like glass cats on the bottom step, turning their heads together, watching as I leave. Their eyes peer out at me from a world of well-timed leaps and near catastrophes, unexplained absences, the skill that makes them cruel.